Thank you, Ryan, and thank you for Joe and team for leading us so beautifully this morning. Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you. That was very muted. You must all be new here. Try that again. Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you. Thanks. That's a lot better. We had a really good weekend last weekend with our healing conference. Really just wish that the next Sunday we could have people one after another just stand up and say, how was your weekend? And what was happening in your life during that time? Sometimes it takes a few weeks for the stories to begin to trickle in before we can give space to those. So please let those stories do come in. As I've thought about the healing conference, even this past week, one of the things that has kind of freshly occurred to me again in the last couple days, and that is, if you look at the Gospels, how central healing is there. Like healing coming from Jesus isn't a little peripheral stream in the Gospels. If you read the Gospels, it's just page after page, there's just stories of healing, isn't there? Just Gospel after Gospel, wonderful, rich stories, one after another, of healing flowing from the person of Jesus. And I think that's why a number of years ago I heard healing referred to as the dinner bell for the gospel. And I think what they mean by that is, if you'll notice that people received healing from Jesus before they even needed to call him Lord and Savior. Before they even needed to fully understand who he was, to fully appreciate his messiahship, to fully accept him as the Son of God, healing was something that flowed so freely from him that he gave it away without requiring discipleship. But it's also one of those things that, having received and tasted of how good he was, just having received some of that healing from Jesus, was one of the things that made people want to know more and to become his disciples. And so healing for us wasn't just a conference. It's not just something we do once a year. The healing ministry of Jesus is a very deep part of our fabric. And because of that, I actually want to preach on it again. I know you're probably thinking, we have heard a lot about healing. But there's a couple reasons why I want to speak on it again this morning. And in some ways, I want it to continue to become a deep part of us. There is all kinds of us that are new here today. And so I want to respect that those of us that have been on a journey for a number of years, we get a certain vocabulary that we're familiar with and that we're on a common pursuit. And so we, in a sense, can assume that everybody coming in shares that vocabulary and is on that pursuit. And it's not a healthy assumption to make. And it can make people feel excluded. I'm sorry, could I get someone at the back? Nico, thank you. Bring me a glass of water. Thanks, Nico. And so I don't want to do that. I want to make sure that we're all on board. And that maybe for some people who have taken a few steps in those waters, that maybe you would risk taking some deeper steps. So I'd like to begin this morning with a reading from a psalm, Psalm 147. And the first three verses. I just look down and see Stephen Barber's mom is here. How are you? Is your husband here too? Sorry, can we show you off just a little bit? Maybe you could stand up. This is Stephen Barber's mom. Oh. We go back a long ways. I was on a ministry team, and I stayed in Stephen Barber's house when he was 9 years old. Don't believe everything he tells you about that story. He says I was up to no good, and I won't tell you what he was saying, but it is not true. I was trying to get him to like gamble or something, but thank you, Nico. But regardless, to have stayed in his house when he was 9 years old. Okay. And now to be working with him. So some of you might know that my stories go back a long ways. I was also invited to Ryan Matchett's house when he was about the same age. And no sooner did I get in his house than Ryan and, where's Miles here, and his brothers all jumped on me and wanted to wrestle. And I'm kind of a wrestler by nature, so we had this great wrestle. But the problem is, Ryan hung on my tie until he stretched it about 12 inches longer than it was supposed to be, back when we wore ties. And it was my favorite tie. And I couldn't wear it because it had become elongated and thin. So I kept it all those years thinking one day I'd meet a seamstress who could cut the skinny part out, the stretch part, and sew it back together. I had this idea. I kept it all these years, and it ended up being in a box like 30 years later, 25 years later. Ryan's on staff. I find that old tie. And so I give it to him. It's in his office, just showing the kind of damage he did me at an early age. And, you know, so many of us go back a long ways. So, more important matters. Psalm 147. Todd's in storytelling mode. Praise the Lord. How good it is to sing praises to our God. Do you feel that this morning? Is that good for you? How pleasant and fitting to praise Him. The Lord builds up Jerusalem. He gathers the exiles of Israel. He heals the brokenhearted and He binds up their wounds. May God add His blessing to this public reading. The last number of Psalms in the book of Psalms, Psalm 147 through 150, are dedicated to a particular purpose. And that is, those Psalms were written to celebrate the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Because in the 6th century, one after another, world empire actually attacked Jerusalem. First of all, the Babylonians, and then the Assyrians in the 6th century, and completely reduced Jerusalem to rubble. They tore down its walls, they ruined the city, they destroyed the temple, and they took most of the key leaders, the key figures, and they deported them. They became exiles. They took them back to their own lands. And so they absolutely ruined this country, and they were in that state of exile for 70 years. And after 70 years, God intervened and brought these people back, and he also had Jerusalem rebuilt. The city was rebuilt, the temple was rebuilt, and restored. And so the psalmists remember that as a pivotal moment of their nation. So pivotal that the last of the psalms, or every one of them, is dedicated to worshiping God for what He did. And so it begins simply, praise the Lord. How good it is to sing praises to our God. And so for some of you, you might be a little bit like me. I didn't grow up in a Christian home, but so praise was new for me. When I first went to a church, I wasn't sure what they're doing. And so why do we sing? And like, does God like it when we sing to Him? It was very foreign language to me. So it took me a while to enter into the fact that there's a lot going on here, that God deserves this. But it's good for me to recognize what's true about God. It's good for me to enter into a life of praise and worship. And so the psalmist said, how good it is. When he sang praises to God, how good that felt. And so I want to encourage you, when you come here Sunday by Sunday, you may be a little bit like me, that in the praise and worship time, you may look around and see how familiar, how warm-hearted that is to many people, and yet that might not seem so familiar to you. But part of the reason maybe why God brought you to our church is that you would begin to explore praise and worship. You'd begin to understand what takes place there. How do you participate? And how do you, your life, how do you get brought to a place that when you leave a church service, you would be able to say with the psalmist, that was really good. How good it was for me to sing praises to God. How pleasant it was. How fitting, of all the things I could have done with a Sunday morning, the Lord's Day, it was fitting, it was right, it was proper that I spent that time praising God. So this is the way this psalm begins. But the worship of the psalmist was directed primarily at one thing. There's one thing he wanted to praise God for above everything else, and that is, verse 2, the Lord builds up Jerusalem. He gathers the exiles of Israel. They would never forget what happened to them. And they'd never forget the fact that because of their own foolhardiness, their own sin and stubbornness, they got taken away from it to another land, but that God had mercy and miraculously brought them back to their land. He thought that was worth praising God for. The Lord builds up Jerusalem. The Hebrew word there is the same. It can mean to build or to rebuild. And so in the case of Jerusalem, God was literally rebuilding it. He was restoring it because it had been so severely broken down. And the exiles, they'd been like scattered. They'd went through the nations of the earth. And here's God reaching his arms around them and bringing them back again. Bringing them back to a place called home. Now, of course, few of us have had a life experience that resembles that. But do you know that numbers of us have? Have you taken the time to get to know some of the African members of our church and get to know their stories? How that when they hear the story of exile, they don't have to think of that metaphorically. They actually did get taken from land to land. And often it wasn't by their own will. Usually twice a year, I go to the northern desert in Kenya called Turkana. I've went there with numbers of people here this morning. But every time I go, I deliberately take Canadians to a refugee camp, a United Nations refugee camp of 100,000 refugees there in Kakuma. And the reason I take them there is that many, particularly East Africans who come to Canada, as refugees come through that camp. And I want Canadians to familiarize with their story. I want them to walk through that camp and know a little bit of what it is like so that when they meet them in Canada, there's a sense of respect for their story. A sense of appreciation for what they've went through. So when we talk about exiles, some of us don't know what that's like, but a lot of us do. Think of the Nepalese speaking people who are actually literally exiles from their country and were in a refugee camp for 15 to 16 years. A land not their own. And now they've been brought here and God has given them a new land and there's a rebuilding and a restoring that has taken place. So please make sure you get to know these precious people and their stories. And yet for the vast majority of us, we weren't exiled in anything like that. And yet we've had experiences that in a sense figuratively were like that. At least, I mean, which one of us haven't had a time of life in which we've experienced a major disruption? A trauma of one kind or another. Or a serious loss. Perhaps it was a place that felt like home to us. Maybe it was a person that felt like home to us. A friendship, a relationship that felt homey and comfortable to us. Maybe it was just a period of life where everything just was so good. And we've lost that place. We've lost that person. We've lost that period of life that felt like home. And ever since that, life feels not the same. We feel a little bit like an exile, like we're not living in the land we'd like to live in. And it's hard to know how to get back. But the Lord binds up Jerusalem. He gathers the exiles. So think of this, 70 years in captivity. And God is bringing everybody back. The city is being rebuilt. The temple wall, or the city walls are being reconstructed. The temple walls are being restored. The exiles are being brought back to their land. And how easy it could have just looked like, well, things are returning to normal now. Look at the walls used to be beautiful. They're broken down. Now they're back in place. And look at the temple is back in place. And I'm back in my old home just many years later. How easy it could have looked like life is back to normal now. We've resuming our routine. And yet there's a whole nother story besides those walls and besides that temple and besides exiles coming back. And it's the story of 70 years in exile to have everything that you know affected, how does that not leave a toll on the human heart? Because that's what verse 3, it talks about the heart and brokenheartedness. And so yes, everything you can see looks like it's back to normal. You're back to your home. It looks like life is normal. And yet inside, you just went through a completely disruptive experience. What toll did that take on people's lives? And would they have known or understood that toll on them? I had an uncle who was in World War II. And he would have survived, and many of his comrades would not have. So what would the trip home have been like? Just thinking of the loss of what he'd seen. And then he comes back to his little town in northern Saskatchewan. Local hero. Everybody excited. Look at the family house. Doesn't look like it's changed at all. Everybody's glad to see you. And I don't even know if an uncle there was any scars to have shown that he'd been in battle. But before long, he was out walking in the country and there was a severe thunderstorm. And his entire war experience came back on him. And he dug a foxhole in the earth with his bare hands. And they found him there a day or two later, hiding in this foxhole. So all of a sudden you realize you return home. Everything looks like it's normal. We'll just return to life as it used to be. And yet he quickly discovered it had made its mark. It wasn't a bayonet mark. It wasn't a gun wound, an explosive mark. But there was a mark on him that war had left that he didn't even realize until it got triggered, until something happened that brought war back to him. And in many ways, every single one of us is like that. He ended up in a war that he did not create and probably didn't want to be in. And then he did his best to serve in. Just like the rest of us, we end up in life situations that we didn't ask for. Most of them weren't even of our own making. But sometimes it takes some time to realize how that affected you until the thunderstorms of life, the later thunderstorms of life begin to come down. And then you begin to realize that it affected you more than you had realized. Why don't we see that? Why didn't the exiles coming back? Why didn't they realize how much it had affected them? Why didn't my uncle at first realize how much war had affected them? Well, it's because you can't see brokenheartedness. You can see walls getting rebuilt. You can see a temple being reconstructed. But you can't see brokenheartedness. How do you measure it? How do you account for it? We'd all agree that we have a heart. And when we use the word heart, we know that we're not only speaking of an organ that pumps blood throughout our body. We're talking about the heart. The human heart means the real you. It means the you that no one can see. It means the you that is bigger and more important even than the part of you that they can see. More than your human body. One person has described the heart as the unrepeatable you. It's the part of you that is unlike anybody else on the face of this earth. And it's where our deepest thoughts dwell. Our deepest dreams. It's where our longings and our hopes, the deep seed of our personality, but it's also where our pain resides. And the challenge with the heart is every one of us know we have a heart, and yet not one of us can see it. So you can't assess it. It's not like, you know, if you're living in a country and there's an earthquake, you send specialists to go along and they assess the damage. They look for the cracks. How do you do that with your own heart? When we have a hailstorm come through, it's not that hard to assess the damage. An assessor goes to the top of the roof, it's visible. It's not really that hard to assess. If it's a tornado, you don't even need a professional to assess it. Yep, there's no house there anymore. I think you're suffered some tornado damage. So if you went to Dr. Crawford in our congregation, or if you went to Dr. Musk and you said to them, I think I got the flu, what would they say to you? Do you think they'd say, well, how do you know? Have you seen the flu bug? How do you know you got the flu? I don't think they would say that. Have you seen the flu virus? What would they say? Tell me how you're feeling. you went to Dr. Shepherd and something went wrong in their back, you can't actually see what's going back there. So what is he going to say? Well, it hurts when you do what? Where are the areas of discomfort? What are the activities that... So what are they looking for? They're getting you to describe the symptoms to them. Because just sitting there looking at you, they can't see it either. Though I'd say Dr. Shepherd, when he treats you, chiropractor here, literally, he's like a, he's reading Braille. He's amazing. What he can read with his fingertips is absolutely astonishing. So they're looking for symptoms. And so you describe your symptoms of the cold or of a flu. This is what I'm feeling. This is where the symptoms are. And from the symptoms, he's been around. They've studied long enough to know that those symptoms mean this. And if that's the case with the human body, so also it is with the human heart. You can't see your own heart, and you can't see where you're fractured. You cannot see the way in which life has affected you, but you can become aware and discerning when it comes to the symptoms. So what do those symptoms look like? Well, there's all kinds. Every area of life. And I mean for this to help some of you who are listening to the healing stuff, but how do you connect to that? So let's take a look at some symptoms. So when I first started on the healing journey, Ron and Ken just ask you these questions, and some of our friends from Florida, and you think they're just being friendly. They are not being friendly. From the moment they open your mouth and asking the first question, they're like doctors of the soul. And you find out very late, very, very, very shortly, there's no such thing as an innocuous question. You realize they've been reading you from the very first question. So Todd, tell me about your life's friendships. What a kind person come up all the way from Florida, ask me that thoughtful question. So I begin to tell them, and then they start dissecting you. So I say, well, I certainly would like to talk about a few of them, and they're before Lethbridge, a different season, and yeah, I'm never quite sure. I understand those friendships. Why? What happened to them? Well, I don't even know. All I know is that they seem to be really close, and we never had any incident, but 10 years later, I still show up with every birthday with a gift. I still show up every Christmas. I still phone. I go visit. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, I just wonder why they don't ever do the same back. And he said, after 10 years, you still do that? I said, yeah. One of them asked me, so why do you do that? I said, because I'm loyal. And his response is, that's not why you do that. I said, that's my best shot. I told myself my whole life that's why I do that. Well, then you're the doctor of the soul. You tell me. Wow, he proceeded to tell me things. He said, Todd, if 10 years later, if you're doing all the giving and they're doing none of it, that is not a friendship. Friendships by definition are mutual. How come I was 46 years of age and never thought of that? Because it was a symptom that somewhere along the line I believed that if I was going to have friends, I've got to keep it up all the time. And that they may never add anything to it, but that's probably the best I could expect. I can't see my own heart, but I've become to be aware of symptoms. That's called a friendship wound. So how's your friendships doing? And what symptoms do you see in yourself? You see, because lots of stuff happens to us, but it's our pain in our heart that affects how you read life, how you interpret it life. And so what's happening to you, but how do you interpret it regarding your friendship? I've interviewed lots of people. I don't have any friends. Why do you think that is? And find at the base of it every time, there's a friendship wound that somewhere along their story, they've felt abandoned, and they really were abandoned. And so they told themselves, that's the kind of people I attract. No one will ever go the mile with me. Everybody will always eventually leave me. And so once you believe that, it becomes self-fulfilling. You don't even realize it. It's only since healing I can read people better. I watch people. I watch them saying, I'd really like friends, and pushing you away at the same time, giving you every reason why you should check out. And then wondering why people do. I've went up to people in church and said, how wonderful it is to have you. You're new here. Yeah, don't worry. I won't be here for long. I was like, okay, I just wanted to welcome you. Next Sunday, hey, is it ever nice to see you again? Hey, I'm not going to probably be here for very long. That very person, 3 months after me doing that, said to me, I ran into them just outside the church and they said, yeah, we've been going there for 3 months. What an unfriendly place. I realized I might as well tell them the truth. What have I got to lose? I said, actually, that's not the truth. You got so wounded in your last church that now your entire body language says, stay away from me. A loving community will pick up on signals. A community has to be safe, so they'll pick up on your signals. They'll even pick up on your body language. And so if you say, stay away, guess what they'll do? Hey, I can respect that. I'll do that. So guess what? You're saying, stay away, and then you're upset when people do it. And if you don't figure it out, it'll haunt you the next season, and the next season, and the next season. It's called a symptom. You can't see your own heart. But you can ask God, help me to understand where the symptoms lie. For me, probably much more than friendships, it's been in marriage. I think just because of Sherry's story, we tell about this openly, but when Sherry got hurt when we were first married, her tendency was to shut down and withdraw. And it was so easy for me to diagnose that. Yeah, look at that pain. So then I would go to work and say, hey, why are you so withdrawn? Hey, why don't you come out of that hole? Hey, what's wrong? And I would ask her so many questions, thinking I was being the best husband in the world, but guess what all my questions felt like? Hounding and pressure. Even the last couple of weeks, the Lord has been speaking to me about impatience. How impatient I was with Sherry at the early stages of her healing journey. That I could not leave it alone. And I thought she was the wounded one. But I didn't realize it was my pain that says, I gotta fix this. I gotta solve this because maybe it means I'm not a good enough husband. And that when she's not happy, how could I be happy? Felt like nothing in my life could be right when she wasn't feeling okay. That my joy went up and down with her emotional state. And here I thought she was the one that was wounded. So I gotta quickly solve this so I can feel her favor again. I didn't see that in me for 25 years. I couldn't see my own heart. I didn't even know how to diagnose the symptoms. And now I realize I can see myself looking back as, wow, I have all kinds of symptoms. That somewhere along life, for every single one of us, every single one of us has a heart. It's part of what makes us human. And a part of us, at some point in life, in our story, that heart has suffered damage. Not one or two or three of us, but every single one of us. It's called the human condition. Having a heart is what it means to be human, but having that heart being damaged is what we call the human condition. In other words, it's true of every one of us. It's not, the world doesn't divide into people that have had breaking heart experiences and those that haven't. The world divides into people that know it and the people that don't. People that will risk seeing it and people that won't. And so here in marriage, it took me forever for me to want to see that I was displaying more symptoms than she was. So sure, so marriage, that's what happens. It's two sets of pain coming together and colliding in the middle. And if you don't see that your own pain is playing into this, what are you going to do? You will end up playing a blame game. There's something wrong with you. Why won't you love me the way I deserve to be loved? Why won't you come through? Why do you withdraw? If you can't see the way this works, that your pain is playing into it, you will always end up playing a blame game. You'll either blame yourself. In other words, the reason they're doing this is I'm the worst possible husband on the planet. Or you will blame them. And neither of them is going to make you a terribly happy person. symptoms. I can't see my heart. But eventually I'd think, when Sherry withdraws, it drives me nuts. And I used to say to myself, why does that drive me so nutty? Like, why inside can she do something this big, but my response inside is so disproportionate. I feel this much inside when she does this much. And I used to wonder that. It's a symptom that I couldn't just leave it alone. Just be patient. I couldn't just leave it in the hands of God and say, you're better with people's hearts than I am. I'll entrust her to you. That was never good enough for me. So what are the symptoms that you show? I think one of the places where I see symptoms most in my own life and others is in the area of conflict. When I used to do pre-marriage counseling, one of the very first questions I would ask people is, tell me about your last fight. They think, didn't we come here for pre-marriage counseling? Not like boxing lessons. No, tell me about your last fight. Tell me about your last disagreement. Because it was like a microscope. I could understand so much of what was in the dynamics that were occurring in that relationship. Both, if they said to me, we've never had a disagreement, I'd be like, really? No. It's because at least one of you has grown up in a home where you never saw conflict done well. And so you fear it. And so you're mistaking passivity for lack of conflict. So tell me about your angry parent you grew up with. It's just like a microscope, people's. So how are you in times of conflict? Do you shut down completely? That's a symptom. Do you come on like a wolverine out of a hole? They're like, that person is normally kind of quiet, mild-mannered until they disagree with you. Isn't it true? I think there was times years ago, I used to come on too strong, mostly because I was so afraid of conflict that when I would engage it, I would come on too stronger than I wanted to and then think, what are you doing, Todd? Calm down. I've had close friends who seem really mild-mannered, but when they get in conflict, they do. That's where I devise that saying. They come out like wolverines. And I've actually allowed myself to just be cut up a little bit. I know that in an hour it'll pass. And then I'll say to them, is the wolverine kind of time to go back in your hole again? Like, you done cutting me? You can go on for a while if you want, but can we talk now? Now that you're done slicing me? And they don't even know why they do it. Because conflict feels like a threat. And so their defense mechanisms kick in so strong. So how do you do in conflict? How do you do in times of disagreement? How do you handle that? How do you manage that? Because boy, we learn a lot about ourselves. This morning, what did you learn about yourself in worship? When God is there in one way or another trying to tell you, I love you, how easy is it for you to receive love? One of the things that came up for healing in me in my marriage is that Sherry can feel very deep and wonderful things in her heart, but she didn't used to be very expressive with those things. So I said to Ron one day, why won't my wife just tell me, you're a great husband? And this was his answer. Todd, there's nothing wrong in a husband wanting to hear that from his wife, except that in your case, the reason you want her to say that is because you don't believe it yourself. And as long as you don't believe it yourself, she can say it 100 times a day, and it will not leave its mark. And then I got thinking about how many times has she said, I love you, or done something, and I find my way to deflect it. Oh, she's just being nice. Oh, she didn't really mean that, but she doesn't love me as deeply as I love her. some way to minimize it or deflect it or discredit it. So what do you do to your husband or wife when they do that? When they say, I love you, and it never counts, what are they going to do? They're either going to stop saying it because it doesn't seem to matter to you, or they're going to just frenzy. They're just going to overcompensate and tell you so many times until it drives you nuts because you can't accept it. So what is that thing inside of our hearts that wants so desperately to be loved, and yet when someone does it, we struggle desperately to receive it? And if you struggle with that, I promise you, your children will struggle with it double. They will struggle with it twofold. In other words, this is worth learning. If when people or God says over you wonderful things and you struggle to receive it, don't be surprised if your children struggle with it double. Symptoms. You cannot see your heart. But you can see the symptoms. So I want to give you a moment to reflect. Where do you see your symptoms? Joyce Myers produced a book. I never needed to read the book. I just thought the title was so good. It was called Approval Addiction. Get this. I bought it for my wife. Pre-healing. Pre-healing, I'm going to add. I bought it for Sherry. Thinking, I don't struggle with that. Oh, I actually had someone who's been disagreeing with me recently bought me a book and underlined with it in it all the parts that they wanted to draw attention for me to read. And told me that. It's great. In bright yellow marker. And I'm going to read it because I want to learn. And where I go wrong, but I still thought it was fantastic. Here's a book. I've underlined all the parts where you go wrong, Todd. It's good. That's a good friend. And that's not the time where you respond with, do you want me to get you a book? What not to say? Do any of these chapters happen to pertain to you? Like, there's all kinds of things you just do not say. You just say, thank you for the lovely book. And I meant that. I will read. I'm planning to read it this week so that I can make sure my heart receives what it needs to receive. So I want you to bow your heads with me in a word of prayer. I want you just to ask the Lord, Lord, I don't really get the healing stuff. Why not? Because I can't see my heart. But where are the symptoms that you probably do see? Do you find it hard to love your kids? Do you find it hard to be affectionate with your kids? I mean affectionate. To put them on your lap and hold them for a long time. Kiss them on the forehead and hope that they'll never get off your lap. Are you emotionally withdrawn from your husband or wife? You're there, but not really there. You find that your first instinct is always to find someone to blame. Just symptoms. At some point of life, I am so sorry to say someone did that to you. They hurt you and they blamed you. They made it all your fault. But now you carry a spirit of that. You are now hurting others where you yourself have been hurt. And it's time to get some healing from Jesus. Do you look at work in an unnatural way? It's like a pain suppressor. Lord, speak to us. Lord, speak to us. Because Jesus leads with a healing ministry. Read the Gospels afresh. Healing is so strong in Jesus' ministry. And one of the ways he draws us to himself is by saying, will you let me heal you? After which we become better at being loved, at receiving love and giving it. Do you find it hard to believe? You find it easy to believe that God could bless other people, but it's so hard to believe that for yourself. Then listen to the word of the Lord. The Lord builds up Jerusalem. He gathers the exiles of Israel. He heals the brokenhearted. And he binds up their wounds. Do you find it easier to love your sons than your daughters? Do you find it easier to love your daughters than your sons? Do you find it hard to have sustained friendships? To work through times of conflict and to come out the other side. To relate to those in authority. Teachers, professors, employers. Pastors. So Lord Jesus, we want to imitate the lives of those in the Gospels who saw healing flowing from you. And they went and just to touch the hem of your garment. They wanted that healing so bad that flows from you. That they took the necessary steps. So Lord, for this morning, who is it that you're calling to take the necessary steps, to take the plunge, as it were, and to trust you, to heal those parts of them that they cannot even see?
So we want to just continue to listen to what the Spirit has to say to you.